Spirit would lead us and teach us in this time. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. The book of 1 Kings. That's where we're in. We'll just go back to this diagram. Remember, helping us see what we're focusing on. We're in the historical books, of which there are 12, from Joshua to Esther. And right in the middle, you'll see there 1 and 2 Kings. These would have been one book in the original Hebrew Bible. And the book of Kings, I like to think of it as a spotlight that is on the throne of men during this particular season of about 450 years from around David and Solomon's time all the way through to the last final king of Judah with the Babylonian captivity. So it's looking at the throne of the king in particular, and of course how his reign affects the rest of the kingdom consequentially. So it traces the history of all the kings from Solomon to the Babylonian captivity. If we look at a quick chart here, the most important thing to understand in this history, and of course it can get quite complex, but the simple outline of it is you have what we could call the United Kingdom, not our United Kingdom, but the United Kingdom under Saul, David, and of course Solomon, his son. And this is when all of the tribes were united under one king in one kingdom. Under Solomon's son, namely Rehoboam, there was a division in the kingdom, and that's what's represented on this chart here. From this point on, from Solomon's son Rehoboam, you have the divided kingdom. You have what's called the northern kingdom, or more commonly known as Israel, and the southern kingdom known as Judah. The capital here in the north was Samaria, and the capital in the south, of course, was Jerusalem. So this history, about 120 years, and then the divided kingdom, which basically goes up to, if you can see that line there, goes up to the Assyrian captivity in 722. And then this little bit here we call the surviving kingdom, because the southern kingdom survived the northern kingdom by about 130 years. The north went away in the Assyrian invasion, and the south survived about another 130 years until the Babylonian captivity. So that's the basic outline of it. Of course, we know at the end of this, you can see here, this period, we have the captivity, which was 70 years. And then after the captivity, you have the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. They're the last of the historical books. If you were to put the Bible on a timeline, the book of Nehemiah would be the last historical book. We don't see that because, of course, it's not the end of our Old Testament. We've got all of the prophets. But we would pick up the prophets and we would drop them into the timeline, and Nehemiah would be the last. So that gives us a little outline. So that's just another diagram explaining the same thing. Here you can see the 12 tribes, and Rehoboam is Solomon's son. He was given the southern kingdom, namely just two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, and then the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes, under Jeroboam. And from that point on, we have the two kingdoms. And through the book of Kings, predominantly, from about 1 Kings 12 on to the end of 2 Kings, if you imagine a camera, it goes up to the northern kingdom and looks at that king, and then you'll see it flip down again. It will say, oh, and the king of Judah is doing this, and then it will look at the next king of Judah, and then it will go up to the king of Israel, and it kind of does this a little bit. I remember in my study Bible, I got two different color highlighters, and I just highlighted when the kings changed to help me see where it was going to the north and the south, because they were existing at the same time. Some of these kings were at odds with each other. Some of the kings between Israel and Judah even fought each other. Some of them helped each other. Some of them clashed with each other, made alliances, whatever. Why was the division?
What caused it? Was it a falling out?
Yeah, we'll look at that. It's chapter 12. It's effectively how we did a message on it in the church one time. It was how Rehoboam And when he succeeded his father, the people pleaded with him to not be as hard as his father, and he didn't listen to them. So the kingdom divided because of that. That's a good read in chapter 12. And there you can see again a map of the north and the south, of course, surrounded by these different people groups and tribes and other kingdoms. If we were to look at a quick outline of the book of Kings, you'd see from 1 Kings chapter 1 all the way through to 1 Kings 11, this is what we could call the United Kingdom. Obviously, it doesn't mention David and Saul. They've already gone. But this is the United Kingdom under Solomon, the first half of this book of 1 Kings that we're going to look at. Then you can see from chapter 12 all the way through to about halfway through the book of 2 Kings. So from 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17, we could call that the United Kingdom. Divided Kingdom, thank you. Divided Kingdom. So again, that's where you have the north and the south running alongside each other. And then, again, the Assyrian captivity happens, but the southern kingdom survives about another 130 years or so until the Babylonian captivity, and that is recorded at the end in chapter 25, the last chapter of 2 Kings. So the purpose of Kings, remember them, 1 and 2 Kings being one book in the Hebrew Bible. So the purpose of Kings, there are several. First of all, as the name implies, it records a very clear, accurate history of the kings. It gives the dynasties of the kings, how long they would last, how long the king reigned, how old his son was when he took the throne. It's a very detailed account, along with chronicles as well. Secondly, it shows that the success of a king or a nation was how he responded to God's word or the law or the prophets. If he humbled himself and responded well, there was a blessing on his throne, on the kingdom, and on the people, and on the land. Thirdly, the exiles have a preserved record of why they are in captivity. If you were a Jew and you were taken captive into Babylon and you had the question, how did we get here? You could read the book of Kings, particularly 2 Kings and how it leads up to the Babylonian captivity. And you could see clearly how that happened. Number four, it shows God's covenant faithfulness despite the enemies and the failures. In other words, when you read this history, even though most of the kings were not compliant with God's law, most of them were at best bad and at worst evil, you still see that God didn't ultimately forsake them. Yes, he disciplined them. He used other peoples to do that. Ultimately, he took them into a foreign land for a captivity, but never forsook them completely. And then lastly, we could say there's an application for the New Testament believer in the governing of our own life. If you think of the picture of a king on a throne and his sphere of influence, and the key to his reign and his life being his heart being humble before God, there's a lot of rich application when you consider our life and our calling. You could say the king on the throne is our will. And does that bend in humility before God or not? If we took the book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings and we considered the beginning and the end, there's some interesting contrasts. These are just some points to give us an overview, a taste. 1 Kings, of course, begins with David handing the baton over to his son. So it begins with the reign of David, the king who was to be a model of a successful king with his heart before God all through the rest of the history. But 2 Kings ends with the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's conquest. So if you read the beginning of 1 Kings and the end of 2 Kings, you'd think, okay, what happened? What happened? Again, it opens with Solomon's glory. We'll see in these early chapters Solomon building the temple, a glorious temple, showing God establishing the kingdom under Solomon. But then we can see it ends with the shame of Jehoiachin. This is the king who was finally led into captivity into Babylon. glory to shame, quite a contrast. The blessings of obedience, the curse of disobedience, also is another contrast. The opens with the building of the temple, it ends with the destruction of the temple. First Kings, we see it tracing the progress of apostasy. We see the seeds of that with Solomon, and we see it blossoming with fruitful rebellion against God all the way through the kings. And you can see that there are consequences for that. And again, we could drop the prophets right here, the prophets having a voice. Some prophets had their ministry in the south, some in the north, some to Israel, some to Judah. But they were saying, you know, if you're not careful, there's going to be consequences. And he warned the north. Then the Assyrians came in. And then some prophets in the south said, hey, you see what just happened to the north? It's going to happen here too. And finally it did. So the progress of apostasy shows how the kings failed to rule the people. Same thing, weren't listening to the prophets, etc. And eventually God dealt with that. First Kings introduces us to a very unique prophet, Elijah, a prophet who doesn't have a book named after him, but we read of his ministry in these chapters, 17, 18, 19, etc., First Kings. Very unique prophet because he is accompanied with incredible miracles. And in Second Kings, we see Elisha have his ministry as well. And then we could see the long-suffering of the Lord, because we're talking about a few hundred years, 450 years from beginning to end, but eventually the judgment did come. So if we glanced at this handout before we actually get into 1 Kings itself, you can see that the first 10 chapters or so, Solomon in all his splendor. We'll see him crowned, he becomes king. We read phrases like, and the Lord established him. There's lots of conclusive statements. So the Lord established him. So all the kings of the earth inquired of Solomon's wisdom. And all of they were paying tribute and his riches were growing. All of this is happening in these first early chapters. The temple is built, of course, 5, 6, 7, and 8 chapters. And there's a few warnings that are echoed through these chapters to Solomon. Oh, if you walk in the ways of David, your father, you'll be blessed. But if not, and there's a few warnings, Solomon would have been good to hear them. And then chapter 11 is, of course, the famous chapter where Solomon, with his wives and the persuasive effect it had on his heart, leading him into his own idolatry, etc., and then the split of the kingdom from chapter 12 and on, under his son. Okay, so that's just a little outline to give us an idea. I don't know if there's any more charts. Are there? Yeah, we'll get there when we get there. Okay. So when we come to chapter 1, it opens with King David, who we studied back in 2 Samuel, in his twilight years, we could say on his deathbed. He's around 70 years old. He's reigned for about 40 years. And now he's at the end. He's at the end of his reign. Maybe I'll hide this for a minute because I don't have anything on there. And in verse 5, we can see his oldest son, whose name was Adonijah, exalted himself and wanted to be king. David, we remember, was taken from the sheepfolds in God's plan. God appointed him. God blessed him. This is very different to Adonijah. He wanted to force his way into the throne. It's an insightful verse, particularly for parents in verse 6. It says, David had not disciplined him. He was a spoiled child. David never asked him, why are you doing this? He just let him have what he wanted. And now this spoiled child is the oldest of the sons, and he wants to take the child. He attempts to gain the throne before David dies. He confers with certain key men that help him, like Joab, who we remember was in David's army, Abiathar, the priest, and others. We can see some conspiratorial meetings and plans that are happening here. He's trying to get some into his favor and exclude others. We can see there's a little party or a feast that's pulled together, and he wants to pull in those who he thinks will side with him, and he doesn't invite those he knows will not be with him. For example, Nathan, the prophet to David, Benaiah, who is a mighty man of war, who actually becomes Solomon's chief of the army, and Zadok, the priest. None of these are invited to the party. And that can be how a conspiracy works. It's good for us to be very discerning with that when we're brought into a little group and they want to tell us something about this person, and I'm just telling you because you're so wise or wonderful or beautiful or you can handle it or whatever. And all the while they're sowing seeds because they have a plan to bring division. These guys were not invited to the party, and hopefully we wouldn't be invited either, because it would be clear where we stand. But Solomon is anointed king, because ultimately Nathan speaks to Bathsheba and says, listen, do you realize what's happening? Remember, Bathsheba's Solomon's mother. You realize what's happening? David spoke about Solomon being the king. Adonijah's already, they're rejoicing in him being crowned. We have to do something about it. So they go in before the king in his old age. He responds and says, oh, I agree with you. Solomon shall be king. He shall be anointed today. And that's exactly what happens. With rejoicing and singing, they anoint Solomon. He's made the king. And there is so much noise and rejoicing in the street that they hear it at Adonijah's party. What's all the noise coming from Jerusalem? And as they ask, a messenger by the name of Jonathan runs in, and Adonijah says, oh, Jonathan, you're a man that brings good news. He says, no, not today. It's not good news. Solomon is the king. And David rejoiced in him being king. And so Adonijah runs. He runs to the horns of the altar, of course, in the tabernacle, because the temple's not built yet. He runs to the horns of the altar, which was like a plea for mercy. That it was that you were making a claim for mercy or forgiveness. And Solomon basically says to him, okay, if I see that you really are a worthy, honorable man, I'll let you live. But just know you're on probation, and you be careful, and we'll see what happens. In chapter 2, we see David's final charge to Solomon. He instructs his son. When we think about the book of Proverbs, many of them, in fact, which were written by Solomon, we hear that phrase, as a father would instruct his son, or walk in the ways of the Lord, or does not wisdom cry out, etc. This is really what David said to Solomon in verse 3 and 4. He said, keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, his testimonies, as written in the law of Moses. Verse 4, that the Lord may fulfill his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons take heed to their way to walk before me, you will not lack a man on the throne of Israel. And of course, that's referring to the Davidic covenant, to David's seed. So we could say this was a heartfelt warning from the father to the son. This is the first of four clear warnings that come to Solomon. That he would walk in the ways of his father. The first one is here from David. The next one is in the next chapter, where the Lord himself appears to Solomon and basically says the same thing. Also in chapter 6, we see the word of the Lord came to Solomon. And then in chapter 9, it says the Lord appeared in a second time. So the Lord appears to him twice and speaks to him once in a dream and then once for his father, four times, warning him. So in this chapter 2, David is gone. He's off the scene now. And Solomon does some housekeeping. And in fact, David names three people particularly that he wants Solomon to deal with. In verse 5, he speaks of Joab. We may remember from 2 Samuel, Joab was an unsavory character. We never really got the impression he was fully with David. He always kind of did took things into his own hands. A lot of innocent blood shed because of Joab. And of course, he didn't side with Absalom, but he did side with Adonijah. He was one of the ones that was invited to Adonijah's party. So David said, okay, Solomon, over to you. And by the way, Adonijah, make sure you deal with him. In verse 7, Barzillai, he says, I want you to show kindness to him, for he showed kindness to me. And then in verse 8, Shimei, you may remember, Shimei was the one when David was leaving Jerusalem in Absalom's conspiracy. Shimei was running along the side and throwing rocks and cursing David. And at the time, David's men were saying, do you want us to go and kill him? And he said, no, maybe this is from the Lord. The Lord is dealing with me. And now he says to Solomon, okay, don't hold him guiltless. So, So David passes on. Solomon is now on the throne. His kingdom is being established. And from 13 to the end of chapter, or to verse 25, we can see Adonijah fails his probationary period. He goes to Bathsheba. He says, you know Abishag, who was given to David on his deathbed? If I could have her for my wife, could you arrange that? And he was really making a subtle claim again to the throne to try and take that away from Solomon. Bathsheba was either incredibly naive or just didn't realize what was happening, or she didn't care, whatever. But Solomon certainly realized. He said to his mother, what do you want to ask? Do you also want to ask for the kingdom? He will die today because he has not shown himself honorable. And Benaiah, he sends Benaiah to strike him down or fall upon him. And of course, that was with the sword, and brought an end to him. And then Abiathar the priest, this is verse 26 and 27, is banished to his hometown. Solomon spares his life because he, again, had been faithful during Absalom's time. That was a time where men's character and allegiance was certainly tested as much as it could be. And Abiathar the priest was one who sided with David. However, he had sided with Adonijah more recently. So he wasn't killed, but he was just banished to his hometown. But he still had an office and a function in the priesthood. And then lastly, Joab. This is verse 28 to 35. Again, Joab runs to the horns of the altar, like Adonijah had done. But Solomon says to him, says to Benaiah, no, you can end his life. So he does that. And Benaiah becomes the head of the army in Joab's place. And then the last one to be mentioned in this chapter is Shimei. Solomon also gives him a probation. He says, listen, you are to stay in Jerusalem. If you ever leave Jerusalem, you're signing your own death warrant. Do you understand? Repeat it after me. And Shimei says, oh, I get it. Thank you. I will stay in Jerusalem. He says, here is the brook Kidron, or the Kidron Valley. If you cross the Kidron Valley, you're going to be killed. Do you understand? Yes. About 7 years later, a couple of Shimei's servants run away. He goes after them to Gath, and Solomon hears about it, and he said, tell me what we didn't understand. And Shimei, again, Benaiah fell upon him. At the end of this chapter, we read that phrase again. And the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. So these early chapters showing the transition from David to Solomon, showing Solomon putting his house in order, putting men next to him he knows have been faithful to his father that show allegiance to him. And chapter 3, this is the famous chapter where Solomon asks for wisdom. But we can also see some seeds of defeat in this chapter. They're going to bear fruit a little bit later. We can see the opening of this chapter that Solomon makes an alliance with Pharaoh in Egypt. And alliances obviously, not obviously, but are often accompanied with marriages. So Solomon marries Pharaoh's daughter, makes an alliance with Egypt. And this is the beginning of many such alliances. The problem with it, of course, is that when, and this is why God would say, don't marry outside of Israel, because what would happen is they would bring their gods and their idols and their worship, and God warned Solomon and said, oh, they're going to turn your heart away. And that's exactly what they did. So in this chapter, we see it. These two little things that eventually will bring the downfall of Solomon's kingdom. Number one, the alliances with other kingdoms, which involved him multiplying wives. And then also the worship. You'll see here in verse 3 of this chapter, it says, he loved the Lord, only he sacrificed in the high places. So you can see he intended, he desired to follow in the path of his father. He wanted to, and yet he let his guard down. He didn't guard his heart. He wasn't careful. He wasn't circumspect enough. And those seeds will bring him down. So he worshipped at the high places. By the way, the high places where the pagan peoples would worship on the mountains or under certain trees in the mountains. At this point, it wasn't such an abomination because the temple wasn't yet built. It will become such a clear act of disobedience and abomination to God. And yet we still see the seeds taking place here. They weren't to worship that way. And of course, they're only to worship the Lord. In verse 4, we see he offered 1,000 burnt offerings in the high places. It was to the Lord, but it was in the high places. It was a step in the wrong direction. We could say, in contrast to David, David certainly had his failures, but as the Lord said of him, he had a heart after me. David had a heart after God. And even when he failed, we see it in the Psalms, oh, how quickly he rebounded and sought the mercy of God and rebounded back to God, didn't preserve his life. We see that contrast with Saul. When the prophet came to Saul and said, oh, you've sinned, he defended himself. He said, what? I performed the commandment of the Lord. But when Nathan came to David, albeit it was a few months down the line, but when he said, you are the man, David said, I have sinned. And he was quick to, and wrote Psalm 51, and quick to look for God's mercy. In other words, to recognize his error. We're not seeing that so much in Solomon. But here in this chapter, right after offering these burnt offerings, we see the Lord appear to Solomon and asked him the question, ask what I will give to you, and it will be given. And in verse 9, Solomon says, give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may be able to discern between good and evil. So Solomon was obviously recognizing a deficit in his own heart and life, a need for wisdom to govern the people. And God says, oh, because you did not ask for riches and honor, I will multiply that for you. I'll also give you what you did not ask, in verse 13. And we can see another warning is echoed with this appearance. Verse 14 and 15, there's a warning. Then he comes to Jerusalem and stood before the ark and offered, not in Gibeon. And perhaps that's significant. He offered the burnt offerings in Gibeon on the high place, but after meeting the Lord, he came back to the tabernacle and offered there. In chapter 4, we see Solomon's administration. Who were his guys? Who were leading? Who was the priest, etc.? Who were his officials? Who was leading the army? He's got 12 governors listed there that were running the tribes and the kingdom for him. Verse 21, we see again these conclusions that he was established. He reigned over all the kingdoms And these other kingdoms were serving him and sending tribute. In other words, taxes, paying taxes. And this is how Solomon's wealth was being multiplied for him to become not only the wisest man on the earth, but the richest man on the earth. Verse 24 says that he had peace on every side. This was one of the reasons God had said, I won't have David build my temple, because he said, David, you're a man of war, but your son, who will be a man at peace, will build my temple. And then in verse 26, it says he had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen? 12,000 horsemen. And there's an interesting verse we would allude to. I did have a slide, sorry, but there's an interesting verse back in Deuteronomy 17. Remember, that's hundreds of years before. This is a prophetic passage that looks ahead to this time of the kings. And it says, when you have a king that comes and sits in the throne, make sure he does not multiply these three things. And it was wives, it was gold, and it was horses. Interestingly enough, these were the three things that Solomon certainly did multiply. And again, in that warning, it says, because if he does, it will turn his heart away from me. And here we can see, okay, he had 40,000 stalls of horses. When we go to Israel, you can visit sites where you see the remnants, the remains of those stalls. However, his wisdom and his understanding was above measure. By the way, to have wisdom doesn't mean you always make wise decisions, right? Obviously, right. Because people say, well, how, he had so much wisdom. Well, why did he do what he did? Well, you can have wisdom, but you still got an old sin nature. You still got temptation. You still got your weaknesses and your lusts, and you can make bad decisions, as we all know. But verse 31, he was wiser than all other men and fame in all the nations round about. He wrote 3,000 proverbs, some of which, of course, were inspired and we have in our Bible. He wrote 1,005 songs, one of which was inspired and we have in our Bible, the Song of Solomon. He wrote Psalm 72, the book of Ecclesiastes, as we said, many proverbs. And many, verse 34, men came from all the peoples of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Oh, we would love to have heard him speak from his wisdom. And he would speak about trees and birds and reptiles and fish and all of those things. But the greatest thing to hear him speak about would have been his Lord. And of course, this is when the Queen of Sheba comes in verse 10, chapter 10. That's what she will hear. The next few chapters, chapters 5, 6, 7, and 8, are speaking about the temple. And of course, now is the time, after all the wandering wilderness journey of bringing the tabernacle all through for 40 years through the wilderness, and finally the ark was still in the tent or the tabernacle through Saul and through David. Although David brought it to Jerusalem, but now is the time for the temple to be built. And chapter 5 opens with the king of Tyre, who was a close friend of David. It calls him a friend there. It says he was a lover of David. He sends to Solomon, and Solomon says, oh, I'm going to build the house that my father wanted to build for the Lord. And the king of Tyre says, oh, I would love to help you. So he sends cedars from Lebanon. And he says, oh, I'll do all that you desire. In verse 13 through to about 17, we see some comments on the work that was being done. Incredible amounts of work for years and years. The temple itself, which was glorious and wonderful and beautiful, but not a huge the actual structure itself, not so huge, but it took 7 years to do it because of the intricacy and the gold and the carving and everything. And then other buildings that he built, his own house and other buildings took another 13 years. And it tells us in verse 13, he had a labor force of 30,000 men. In verse 15 and 16, 70,000 bore burdens, 80,000 worked in the quarries, and 3,000 were supervisors over them. And they would cut these large stones for the foundation of the temple. In fact, when we visit Jerusalem, you can go, you have the Western Wall, and to the side, you can go through the Western Tunnel. And when you go through the Western Tunnel, you get to see, and your hands can run down what's considered, it's called the Western Stone. It's one of the largest cut stones in any building around the world. It's listed on along the largest stones. It's 517 tons. And you look at this block and you think, how on earth did they cut this and move this and get it into position? It's a marvel. And that's what we read happening here. In fact, it says in verse 7 of chapter 6, that the stones were finished at the quarry so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built. So they would prepare these stones, they would measure them and get them ready to perfectly fit, and then they would bring them in and lay them. Quite something. When you read about these numbers and these amounts of time and these immense building projects, make a mental note of that, because this is part of the reason that feeds into why the kingdom divides, because Solomon was so hard. It was a glorious kingdom, and the kingdom was established, but people were really put to work, and Solomon was a hard taskmaster for sure. So chapter 6, we can see the description of the glorious temple. Chapter 1, he begins to build the house of the Lord. And what's amazing is, you can read the description of yourself, and of course online you can. I'll have some pictures on the next slideshow. But online you can see some artist conceptions of Solomon's temple and what it would have looked like. It was really something to behold. Everything inside was entirely overlaid with gold. Well, in fact, maybe I did have time. Yeah. Okay. So. This would have been something like, in fact, the outer courtyard would go like something like this. And this is the inner courtyard. And then this is the perimeter. But this part is really the temple itself. This is the entrance. And this would be like, remember what the tabernacle was like with the outer court? This would have been like the outer court. And then this would have been what the tabernacle was. But of course, it was built, it's probably twice the size of the tabernacle. Solomon definitely embellished it. Incredibly, and all of the inside would have been overlaid with gold. When you read through this chapter, in chapter 16, chapter 6 in verse 19 and verse 20, the inner sanctuary overlaid with gold. Verse 21, the inside of the temple overlaid with pure gold. Verse 22, the entire altar with gold. 28, the cherubim overlaid with gold. Everything was overlaid with gold. If you weren't sure what to do, you went to the foreman. What should we do with this? Overlay it with gold. Everything was just overlaid with gold. Incredible. And of course, the carvings and the details were just incredible. In the middle of this chapter, there's another warning. This is I think this one is a dream, if I remember correctly, and chapter 9 is the second appearance. But this is another warning from the Lord. If you walk with me, if you keep my commandments, then I will dwell with you and not forsake you, etc. These warnings were for a reason. Chapter 7, and we really just want to get to chapter 11 if we can today. Chapter 7, we see this huge complex. Aside from this, the temple, aside from the temple, was all the other buildings, and they are listed in chapter 7, verse 1. It tells us it took him 13 years to build his own house. Verse 2, he also built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Verse 6, he also built the hall of pillars. Verse 7, he built the hall for the throne, the hall of judgment. This is where he would assess certain cases that would be brought to him. And verse 8, he also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken as wife. Oops. And then verse from verse 13, you can read of a man who was brought in for the specific task of working with bronze. So everything was overlaid in gold on the outside, but a lot of things like the pillars and the capitals and the furniture was made of bronze. And this man was brought in to particularly do that. Chapter 8 is the dedication of the temple. It's a wonderful chapter to read. You can read of Solomon's dedication prayer, or the better version, or the amplified version, if you like, is in the Book of Chronicles. But this amazing event where so many sacrifices are made on this day to celebrate and commit unto the Lord, the prayer of dedication, and the Shekinah glory of the Lord appearing here in verse 10. And of course, the wonderful prayer where he says, you can see it there in verse 36 through 38, that God, he says, oh God, if your people turn and pray to your land, to this city, to this house, you will hear them from heaven and you will answer their prayers. Verse 46 to 53, he says, even if they're in the land of their captivity. Again, quite an insightful, prophetic mention. Right at the dedication of the temple, there was this ominous mention of captivity, because, of course, down the line, that's exactly what's going to happen. In verse 63, we can see thousands of animals that were sacrificed on this event. In verse 66, they were glad, the gladness of heart and rejoicing. And then chapter 9, this is the second personal appearance to Solomon. This is the fourth warning. Again, we read, if you do this, it means this is conditional, Solomon. If you do this, or if you don't, there's results, captivity, etc. However, this was certainly a high point in Israel's history. He established them, and that's what these opening chapters show. Now, finally, remember, let's go back to Abraham's covenant. Oh, I will give you this land. I will settle your people in this land. This is the pinnacle of that right here. Solomon, in all of his glory, with incredible influence, the temple finally being built. And these opening chapters framing that for us, showing, look at this. Look what God has done. Chapter 10, of course, the famous story of the visit of the Queen of Sheba, also the King of Tyre visiting. She says she came to prove him with her hard questions. And she is used, of course, as an example of faith by the Lord. If you can read of that in Matthew 12. When he is, remember, Matthew 12 is the chapter when the Jewish leaders finally reject Christ. That's where he says, oh, this is the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. They say, you do this by the devils. This is when he cast out the dumb demon. That's the context that he mentions the Queen of Sheba. After his public ministry, him doing all of those miracles, and instead of them saying, oh, it's the Messiah, they say he does this by the power of the devil. And then he and Jesus says, remember the Queen of Sheba? She went to see Solomon, and one greater than Solomon is here. Quite a rebuke for her, for them. So she came, it tells us, verse 3, nothing was hidden. Oh, we love that. She had her questions, and it says that there was nothing that was hidden. That he could give her the answers to her questions, but also help her define the questions that she perhaps didn't even know she had. I love the fact that it says she came to prove him with hard questions concerning his God. It wasn't she just had questions about life and about fish and science. She wanted to know about his God. And I'm sure most of the questions revolved around that. In verse 5, it says, when she saw the ascent to the stairs, in verse 5, what's the full verse say there? Does anyone have that? 10:5? Yeah, so that's what's such a wonderful phrase. She saw all of that, but it says, when she saw that, the entryway, the stairs, the ascent to the temple of his God, then she was overwhelmed. There was no more spirit in her. And that phrase, remember in the book of Joshua, in chapter 2, I think it is, where it says that the Canaanites, it's Rahab's testimony, when Rahab says, oh, they have heard about Israel's great exploits with the kings beyond the river. And it says, now the hearts of the people are melted. That's this same phrase. Her heart was melted. In other words, there's no more resistance. There's no more opposition. Okay, you win. I'm in. Where do I sign? That's kind of what it's saying. And this is where she was brought to. She was like, okay, I completely, you know, I concede. Verse 7, she says, oh, it's been seen from afar. I've heard, but now I've seen it for myself. And she's overwhelmed. And she, there is the giving of the increased wealth mentioned in verse 10. Verse 11, Hiram again gave gold. Solomon increases even more in gold. We can see in the next 6-7 verses or so, it mentions riches and shields of gold and an ivory throne and gold drinking vessels. We get the picture. His wealth is being multiplied incredibly. And verse 23 sums it up with this phrase, that he exceeded all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And we'll finish today with chapter 11, because here is a sudden, sad turn of events. We've just unfolded those opening chapters, and it should take our breath away in a sense. And this takes our breath away in another way, because of Solomon's sad turn. We see some of those seeds of idolatry and worshipping other gods, etc. We see them beginning to bear some fruit. And verse 1 says, he loved many foreign women. And it mentions them, Pharaoh, the Moabite. These are pagan tribes. They are nations that the Lord has specifically said, you shall not enter into marriage. And of course, why? And there's a very clear reason for Israel being a people set apart, which is one of the purposes of the law that we mentioned at our question time the other night. One of the purposes of the law is to help them remain a sanctified people set apart unto the Lord. And you say, well, why? What? Solomon might say, why can't I marry her? She's so beautiful, Lord. And it would mean that we would have a good relationship with Egypt or whoever. And the Lord says, because surely they will turn away your heart after other gods. And it says that Solomon clung to these in love. I might have a different translation to you, sorry. But he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Which we just have to shake our head at that. It's just, wow, that's a mystery. It doesn't tell us how many marriage counselors he had. It just tells us how many wives. Verse 3, and surely there it is. Verse 3, his wives turned away his heart. Oh, we couldn't have imagined that would happen, but there were certainly the warnings along the way that we read about. And again, we could go back to the three areas of multiplication. Do not multiply gold and silver. But it was certainly happening through the tributes and the taxes and relationships with other nations, which were through the alliances of intermarrying with their wives. And of course, the multiplying of the horses, etc. Verse 4 tells us he did not have a perfect heart as David. And again, that doesn't mean David was perfect. Far from it. The scriptures are not hiding the fact that David was a sinner, that he failed. But Solomon's heart had been now captured by something that God had clearly prohibited. And this was over a long period of time. This wasn't like an isolated sin. This was something that was accumulating over a period of time. Luke 12:34 says, beware where your heart goes, for where your treasure is, your heart will also follow. So these were steps taken over a period of time in a moral decline in Solomon's own heart and life. These alliances that were made were followed by idolatry. Look at verse 5. It says he went after Ashtoreth. This was one of the Canaanite goddesses, a goddess of fertility and sex. And it mentions there in these following verses, the goddess of so-and-so, so-and-so. It mentions them. Listen right there in our Bible. And it says there, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. That's a sad phrase to be attributed to Solomon, isn't it? He did which was evil in the sight of the Lord. When you study the when we study the book of First and especially Second Kings together, you'll notice that this is a way that the kings are introduced. And after him, his son reigned in his stead, and his name was, and he did that which was, either it says, that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, or that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord. And here, Solomon, sadly, it says, what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not wholly follow the Lord as David did. Now, you can't just label a king as good or evil, of course. Many of them started good and ended bad. Many of them started bad and ended worse, ended evil. Many of them started good but ended up as reformers, like completely tearing down the idols, etc. Sadly, there were only four of them, really. But there's differences. It doesn't mean they were like that their whole life, but they made good or bad decisions accordingly. And then Solomon built the high place for Chemosh. Here in verse, is it verse 7 or 8, somewhere in there? The abomination of Moab. And Chemosh, by the way, was an image. I'll show you a slide, another point. It's a large image of a god in metal that had a fire that would be burning under it. And the arms, there's different ideas of what it would be like, but typically the arms above the fire would be where you would offer a baby as a sacrifice. This is what Solomon did. Solomon built a high place worshiping that God. This was one of the reasons that the Canaanite people were on God's judgment list, because the iniquity of the Canaanites finally was full, according to Genesis 15, 16. And now Solomon is building a high place for that God, because that particular wife of Moab, that alliance had turned away his heart. You can see verse 7, 8, and 9. And Molech, an abomination of the Ammonites. This was another fertility god. And he did this for all his foreign wives, all who burned incense, and he sacrificed to their gods. And look at that phrase there. And the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away. And this is Solomon's downfall now. There was the warnings. There was the progressive action, the intermarrying, the accumulation, and now the idolatry, and now there's going to be the discipline. Because Solomon had introduced a principle that sadly was going to deteriorate the kingdom and affect other kings in the future. He took the daughter of Pharaoh. He brought her into his court. These other doors were open for other alliances. Before you know it, he's got almost too many wives to count. So what was the discipline of Solomon? Let's read here. Verse 11. I will rend or rip the kingdom from you, and I will give it to your servant. I will take it out of your son's hand. And of course, his son, who's going to be Rehoboam, who would have succeeded him. But one tribe I will give you for your son, and that tribe namely being Judah. So this is the discipline. Solomon, you're going to lose it all but one tribe. In fact, it was Judah and the smaller tribe of Benjamin. This is all you're going to be left with. All the rest is going to be taken from you. And it's going to be taken, and it's going to be given to your servant. One of your adversaries, one of your servants, is going to be the king of the 10 northern tribes. And in the rest of this chapter, we can see verse 14, it says, the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon. Is that the right verse? Yeah. And you'll read three adversaries, three enemies that God raises up in rapid fire, in succession. The first is Hadad, the Edomite. The second is Rezon. And the third, that's in verse 23. And the third is Jeroboam in verse 26. Now, Jeroboam is the one we want to note, because Jeroboam is the servant or the adversary who eventually is going to go up against Solomon's son Rehoboam. And he's going to become the first king of the northern line, Jeroboam. Maybe it's easy to remember because it's Rehoboam and Jeroboam at the same time. I don't know. Maybe it's confusing. But anyway, this is the Jeroboam that will later split the kingdom. And of course, that's God bringing that to fruition. So you can see Solomon's kingdom, the outward glory of it, but yet an inner decay in the heart. Remember, it was always an issue of the heart. What was happening in the heart eventually would catch up with everything else. So the kingdom, like Rome, if you like, fell from within. And this was what happened here in Solomon's own heart. And the prophecy of Ahijah, who is the prophet who found he finds Jeroboam, and he gets a garment, and he rips the garment into 12 pieces. And he says to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces. And Jeroboam's thinking, I don't know, what's this about? And he said, the Lord, I'm a prophet, and the Lord has told me these 10 pieces of garment represent the 10 tribes, and you will become king over them. So Jeroboam is fearful of his life. He thinks, oh my goodness, Solomon's going to want to kill me. So he flees, but he comes back onto the scene when Solomon's son Rehoboam comes into the throne. And we'll pick up with that next week. We'll start there in chapter 12, which is the split of the kingdom. Okay, so I don't know if anyone has any questions. Feel free if you've got any questions on it. Again, just encouraging you to skim or deeply read, whichever you have time for, over these chapters. And you can jot down questions that may come to mind as you have them. And we'll try and address those at a later stage.